Good evening. First, I wanted to mention that I don't know whether all of you know about Myogen Steve Stuckey, who is one of the abbots at San Francisco Zen Center, who has suddenly been diagnosed with cancer and given only weeks to live. And so, of course, everyone up in Zen Center is chanting for him and lighting incense for him. And he's taking it extremely well, I would say. If you look on his website, you'll see his statement about it, in which he's very sad to be leaving his children, but very philosophical about his situation, very realistic about it. So I thought for us, we don't usually chant for people, but I think each of us has some way of remembering those who are suffering and who we know about. So I'm just letting you know about Steve, who is a man of tremendous integrity. And he was one of the ones who stayed at Tassajara when the fire and were told to leave, and he stayed and fought the fire. Remarkable guy, a cellist, a psychotherapist. He's writing his thesis. He probably won't finish his thesis now. So he's our brother, and I want to remember him this way. So we didn't get along very far with the second precept. I wanted to pass out this copy of Colvin's translation of the Bodhidharma precepts and include Dogen's translation. And so there are three of them for each one of them. Bodhidharma first, then Dogen, and then Colvin. All good company they keep. So if you wouldn't mind sending that around. And then I wanted to share a couple of poems with you. Wendy sent me one that Giroux wrote about generosity. That is exactly a part of this subject of taking what is not given. The other side of it is, of course, generosity, of giving. And so Giroux's words are gratitude. Each turning of a key, raising of a cup, each step forward or blinking of an eye, behind each thought, each beat of the heart, there is deeply hidden, disguised gratitude. A form of Dharma, one of one's true nature. It comes forth the deeper one lives into profound interconnectedness while briefly surfing upon this turbulence of being. Joy, sorrow, love, hatred, destruction, renewal. Vital health, painful illness, dismay, and delight. In their affirmation, recognition, lies the root, the channel to gratitude. Rather than sweet and sugary, gratitude ruthlessly erodes the sense of significant self. The more pervasive our thankfulness, the less necessary we are to ourselves. The starting point is so close, it's hardly seen or felt. So fast, it's already gone when thought about. Let gratitude surround each move, gesture, thought, smell, taste, touch. Each a wonder of being. Each easily overlooked as we go about busily maintaining ourselves all day long. So without should, but with awareness, let us return again and again to this moment, this place, most gratefully. This one was sent to me by one of the people in my writing workshop who read it somewhere and didn't understand it at all because she doesn't know anything about Buddhism. It's written by Jane Hirschfield, and it's an expression of the all-oneness of everything in a very scientific way. It's called My Proteins. They have discovered, they say, the protein of itch, natriuretic polypeptide B, and that it travels its own distinct pathway inside my spine, as do pain, pleasure, and heat. A body, it seems, is a highway, a cloverleaf crossing, well-built, well-traversed, some of me going north, some going south. 90% of my cells, they have discovered, are not my own person. They are other beings inside me. As 96% of my life is not my life. Yet I, they say, am they, my bacteria and yeasts, my father and mother, grandparents, lovers, my drivers talking on cell phones, my subways and bridges, my thieves, my police, who chase myself night and day. My proteins apparently also me fold the shirts. I find in this crowded metropolis a quiet corner where I build of not me Lego blocks, a bench, pigeons, a sandwich, of rye bread, mustard, and cheese. It is me and is not the hunger that makes the sandwich good. It is not me, then, is the sandwich, a mystery neither of us can fold, unfold, or consume. So the basis of this whole study of precepts is the no-self self, or the self of no-self, of this breaking down of all things in just the way that she describes, which also includes everything. And as we proceed through the precepts are all taking apart each aspect of how we are in the world, and exhibits the selflessness of the life of the self, so that it gives us a great deal more clarity to find in no dealing that inside no stealing, generosity lives. Inside no killing life, life continues on. And so it gives us a kind of sturdy place to refer to as we work our way through this moment by moment life. So the precept is really about not thinking of getting something. It isn't so much about not getting something or not wanting to get something. It's about thinking about it. It's about the original desire that rises up in us and taking. I want that. I will take it. I'll get it. I want to obtain it. So it's all a whole aspect of mind around our relationship to the other, whether it's a beautiful person or a flower or a piece of bread. What rises up in us that wants and takes. So I'm hoping that you all have experience around this and are willing to talk about it. Around this, I should refer to this. And actually, there isn't anything from Dogen. And Koban translates Bodhidharma as no sneakily, forcefully taking, or no taking that which is not given. Ultimate recognition is we have nothing that can be stolen. Nothing at all. We don't own anything. If we experience things as one, then it's already ours. Of course, we could carry on that way, and sometimes Koban did that. Somebody would show him something, and he would just walk away with it. Mm-hmm. This is very nice. Oh, and then he made it his. It was shocking. But it's part of a tradition, you know. The other way, you know, somebody admires something, you give it. It's the way that breaks down the barriers between us. It's always the barriers between us that we're working on, putting them away. Someone?
This is such a silly story, but I have a real interest in the things, the leaves that people put out in their green barrels, and I would actually like to take them all home and use them in my garden. And I'm kind of a little self-righteous about, well, they shouldn't be raking up all that beautiful stuff and just throwing it out. And so I noticed that our neighbors had all this. There'd been this was a couple of weeks ago, and there'd been kind of a windstorm, and so there was all this great redwood stuff lying on their sidewalk. And I said to my husband, "Well, do you think it'd be okay if I just went over there and pulled it out?" And I knew that their parents, the husband's parents, were visiting from France, and I thought they were gone. And this is where the word sneakily rings the bell, because there's something kind of, I'm sure they would have said, fine, no problem, but the point was I didn't want to ask them, I didn't think they were there. And I think my point about all of this is it doesn't matter if you're stealing a diamond or a redwood leaf, that the mind, my mind still goes through all this, well, he wouldn't mind. Well, why shouldn't I have them? You know, and just, but then there's also kind of an adrenaline thing that comes up with stealing too, that's kind of the danger, the risk of it.
Which is exciting, and some thieves get off on it. That's why they do it.
I think that if I could sort of, just see that if your mind, well, my mind anyway, just was spinning out of control, and I just realized I had to kind of get a grip. And But before I did that, I went over with my rake and my broom, and there, lo and behold, the French mother-in-law was sitting out in the yard. So I just turned on, I don't think she saw me, I just turned on my heel and fled. I got to meet her later, and she was lovely, but it was just, it was so funny that I thought about whether I would be able to explain this to everybody, but there's something that I got about how universal it is to take something. Donald Lynn talked once about somebody who wanted to take some lemons that were out.
Me.
Was it you?
Yeah, those lemons right over there.
They're still there.
The trees, the old members.
It's just more that it created a lot of complications for me.
Yeah.
And that's what I realized was it was just simpler to not do it. It would have been. And mm-hmm. It would have been a big mistake if I had done it because it would have been really embarrassing.
But if you had gone over and asked about it, that would have
been a fine way,
yeah. Too.
And, yeah. And I will, but it's just that somehow I invented this scenario that, oh, they've gone, they're not there.
Mm.
The gardener's going to come and sweep. You know, I kind of created this pressure situation out of it. So how silly is that?
It's very natural.
But now I can... At some point, I will just say, "Would you mind?" And
mm-hmm.
You know, I wouldn't even be going into their yard, but it's still a little invasive to have somebody out in front.
Yeah.
not at my house.
Well, we're
ready. Yeah. Yeah. You can come to my house too.
Yeah, I have a fondness for fall leaves too. I like to press them down and use them to decorate when we be into that. And my neighborhood, you shouldn't be rummaging around people's trash because there's a lot of homeless people that do that. So, one of my neighbors got very upset I was taking some of his leaves from the curb. Okay. So it's just, you just never know what's important to people.
There's that side too.
Did he want his leaves? Is that there?
Well, basically, I think he thought I was a homeless person rummaging the garbage, I think, and he was just shooing me away. I didn't have a plastic bag with me. I don't know how I looked on this.
Well, in a big city, often everybody's suspicious of everybody else if they don't know. You just don't trust unless you have some basis for the trust. And there is another way of doing that, but the way that we do it usually is just to keep our sense of separation very strong so we feel safer. Jeffrey?
No. There lots of dots here. Well, if this sounds a little scattered, it's just because there's a number of things that this has brought up for me. A couple days ago, I heard Alanis Morissette, "What if God was one of us?" Which has that kind of quality. You know, if you just... When you meet people and the grounds in which you're meeting them is not established, it's a little leaky. It's the person who might be in front of your house collecting a leaf. You think maybe they're going through your garbage or going through something that really maybe absconding with your identity or something like that. That kind of stuff. But what comes up for me will be a kind of defense reaction. But I think my sitting has taught me how to step back, because that's an old habitual way of looking at it. And getting a little bit more information, either visually or actually talking to the person. And that relieves it. And then, over the weekend, Daniel Goleman wrote an article, an opinion piece that came in the New York Times, in which he was talking about how the rich, the people who have the most, tend to have the most narrow view of such things as how to relate to those who have less. And the more you have, the less ability you have to relate to somebody who really doesn't have anything. And he was, economists talk a lot about the gap between the very wealthy and the very poor. And he was looking at it from the viewpoint of the studies that he had been conducting. He was looking at all the research that indicated that he was more concerned with the lack of empathy that was being expressed by the 1%. Mm. And I thought that was really interesting, too. And, well, I'm not in here to judge who might be a 1%er. I don't know. Call me crazy. Maybe there aren't any. Whether we're a 1%er or a 99%er, there's that relationship between having a lot or not having very much. And here's where I think the generosity part of this discussion comes in. And one of the things they found out about people who don't have very much is that they're much more socially conscious of how to relate to those like themselves who don't have much, or people who have more, as opposed to people who have a lot and can't relate to people who don't have as much. And if any of that made sense, it's making sense inside my head, but hopefully I've shared something that speaks in terms of our culture and our society to this great question.
Absolutely. That's very interesting. And I'm sure if you have infinite amount of wealth, then there's no need to relate to anybody anymore. And you really don't have to. You just assign people to do what you want them to do. You have total power over everything around you. It must be a very strange way to live, the way that most of us can't even dream of wanting to live like that.
I think those of us who are on the path of cultivating compassion or working on that, who recognize their own limitations and how we stumble again and again with these very issues.
Yes.
I found it riveting that somebody may not give it up a second thought.
Yeah.
You know, whereas it's like front and center in terms of my practice, how to let that unfold, I see these areas in my life that are real narrow that I need to expand. And of course, this practice gives you opportunities to look at that narrowness and realize how you're kind of coming up short.
And to be willing to meet.
Excuse me, I didn't hear what
to be willing to meet others who are different from me, others who are having a hard time and are suffering. I mean, there's no turning away in our practice. We don't choose to turn away. We choose to be present for everything that comes into us into our experience. And it's a hard practice because of that. But otherwise, it becomes a pretty terrible world. A world of true ignorance, sheer ignorance. If people don't have the experience, then they don't know. I met an old lady on my sidewalk this morning who is from Italy and was talking about how few people know what real poverty is like and how glad she was to come to America. She actually got down and kissed the ground because she was so glad to get out of the misery that she had come from. But if you haven't been exposed to those things, then it's very hard to cultivate empathy. It's just like, you know, feeling for nature, too. If you haven't been in nature, you've seen one tree, you've seen them all. It's just, it doesn't compute. It doesn't, there's no recognition. So it seems like some of our work is just to keep bringing into consciousness the true reality of how things are, the life in things, the suffering in things, that we often would much rather not be exposed to be willing to go there and to be here with it. Yeah, good example.
Can I make one final comment about generosity? And that is, in terms of taking, how I take from the ancestors, you know, because they get it freely. I'm reading Stanley Kunitz, who was a poet who lived to be 101.
Yeah.
And I'm reading the last thing he did. It's called The Wild Grave. And it's a connection between his life of poetry and his garden. Which just strikes right here. and so he's written this in his 90s. And he is so generous with his words. And he has such wisdom about how he connects his life and his passion, you know, the life is made with words, but the words, he's always pointing past the words in his poetry.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking about how much I take from poets and from the ancestors and all their wonderful, all the things that they're providing me, this wonderful, nutritious, supplemental stuff that if I can, you know, understand it and practice with it. The same thing goes with the book we're reading for our book club. It's that kind of a deep, wonderful expression of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
You see, his whole life was dedicated, Uchiyama's, to providing a true way for people to live, you know, from this really amazing place of integrity. And that's the kind of generosity that this second precept talks to me about. Talks to me. Early in my practice, I saw it as no stealing. But now it has more to do with that part you're talking about, the generosity part.
Well, it's big enough to take all of it in and keep us awake. Yeah. Anything else? Next week is the third precept, of course, because it comes after this second precept, which has a number of different translations. On this one, it's no unchaste act. And it's about attachment. In Bodhidharma's words, not to give birth to attachment in the truth of non-attachment, this is called no fulfillment, or no fulfillment of desire. Kogan called it, there are only you and absolute being. So to have two objects as the absolute is the basic confusion about oneself and about the object you are facing. Subjective side, our side, is the problem. I love you. I want you. So it's setting up somebody else where there's only one projection, possible projection, that one is the same as all. And to separate it out and create a possession out of it, and not just sexually, but in many other different ways that we become attached to things and then claim them for our own. Own them in a way that this is not against marriage, this is not against a loving attachment, but it's the kind of attachment that is also completely aware that it's tenuous, very tenuous, fragile, and cannot possibly last. And so instead of claiming the other and saying, well, it's all mine, we have a different relationship, a much more mature relationship, and a much more open to the reality of the other rather than projecting all of our passions on someone else. We begin to be able to clearly see who the other is and how we can be together without adding a lot of stuff to the relationship that just confuses it. So it's sort of like, I see you. I'm willing to see you as you are, as it is, as I am, as we are together, rather than singing violins and roses. So we'll talk about it more next week, but give it some consideration, your relationships and how it works, and where projection comes in, and ownership, how it works and how it doesn't work on many, many different levels. It's one of our most interesting subjects in a way. All of our movies are about it. All of our novels are about our relationships, how they work and how they don't. Lots of romance. So it's 8 o'clock.